You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen on Tuesdays and Sundays after 12 o'clock. Today, I'm pleased to be talking to Bill Harley. Bill is a Grammy Award-winning storyteller. He's an author and a performer. He is genuine and outrageous, vibrant, and he has the ability to connect to kids and adults on a very recognizable and human level. So welcoming you from the East Coast, Bill. Thank you for joining me on Zoom.
It's really great to be with you, Chris.
Well, we have a gale warning going on. And so that made me think that you could start with a song for all the guys and gals that are sitting in their sailboats down in the marina.
It's a deal. Okay. This is about very much one of those things. I should say, I mentioned Galilee in the chorus, and Galilee is the little fishing village that a ferry goes out of in Rhode Island. So here we go.
After 3 months of overcast skies, listening to the weatherman telling him lies, he looked in the mirror, saw a glaze in his eyes, knew that he was fading away. But what's the point of winter if there's rain, not snow? He's still got cold feet and a runny nose. There aren't any colors when the wind blows. Everything is turning to gray. And there's a 20-foot boat in a 12-foot sea that's never been farther than Galilee. At only 5 knots, now you tell me how long it takes to get warm. And there's ice in the rigging and reefs in the sails. Channel 3's talking about a force 10 gale. Winds might shift, but some things prevail. He's already someplace warm. Guess he lost it when his car got towed, stuck on 95 and it was pissing down snow. The tow truck had buffeted on the radio. He took that as a sign. And down at the marina, they're scratching their heads. It's mid-February, everything's still in bed. He wants his boat dropped. Somebody said, man, did you see the look in his eyes? Now there's a 20-foot boat in a 12-foot sea. Never been farther than Galilee. At only 5 knots, now you tell me how long it takes to get warm. And there's ice in the rigging and reefs in the sails. Channel 3 talking about a force 10 gale. The winds might shift, but some things prevail. He's already someplace warm. Down in the islands, it's 80 degrees. The golfers wear a mattress down to their knees. It's a clear blue sky and a steady breeze, but that's half an ocean away. Some folks play in the sun and the sand. He's wearing three sweatshirts, has socks on his hand. Feet are so numb, he can barely stand. He doesn't seem to mind. All you good people here, please take note. Everybody needs some sort of boat when your dream sets sail to keep your life afloat. Some people think you're losing your mind. And there's a 20-foot boat in a 12-foot sea that's never been farther than Galilee. At only 5 knots, now don't tell me how long it takes to get warm. And there's ice in your rigging and reefs in your sails. Channel 3's talking about a force 10 gale. The winds might shift, but some things prevail. You're already someplace warm. You're already someplace warm.
Okay, thanks so much for singing that song. Oh, can you tell us what album that's from?
It's on an album that's called Already Someplace Warm, and it's actually just me. It's just me and a guitar singing. You know, I just have all these songs, and every once in a while, I have to do an exorcism just to get them out. And it's, so it just was, that was literally a clearing of the decks. But it's on a recording called Already Someplace Warm. Well, actually, now I think of it, there's another recording of it from a live recording that I did. That's right, which is probably better known. There's a monologue I do at the beginning called Why I Bought a Sailboat, which is about me losing my mind because of my dog in the middle of the winter. And then that leads into that song.
Okay, well, I'm going to put a link to that on the podcast page when we're done with this.
Yeah, so that recording is called Mistakes Were Made. It was a live recording and they were, so.
Okay, great. The first time I saw you was kind of in the mid to late 80s. And do you feel like that was a huge storytelling sort of renaissance then? You know, when John Adams was on NPR and All Things Considered, and he had storytellers on. And
Noah Adams, yeah. Noah, yes. That's all right. It was. There was this expression that started in the early to mid-70s of people kind of rediscovering storytelling as a performance art. And it's been through a lot of changes since. I mean, you know, it's got a lot of different expressions now, but I kind of made this decision that I was going to be a storyteller. And honestly, I'm honest to God, I drove home and I told my parents what I was going to do. My dad was raking leaves in the front yard. And I went out there, I said, I'm going to try this storytelling thing. And, you know, or at our house, it was like, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. Not a mumbling word from him. He didn't even nod his head. So I said, okay. But I discovered at that time, I mean, it was really interesting when I started to do it. I discovered there were a lot of other people who around that time had decided that they were going to be storytellers. And the National Storytelling Festival, where you saw me first, was one of the places that we kind of met. It was kind of like a little community it's where you discovered your tribe. And I still very much look at that. And I haven't been to a storytelling festival, obviously, for 9 months now, but those are still my tribe. Those are the people that I don't have to explain they say home is where you don't have to explain yourself. And those storytellers and all different kinds of all different backgrounds and, you know, ethnicities and different kinds of stories. And I feel like I've just been really blessed to hang out with all these people who are coming from different backgrounds and have stories of who they are and who their people are.
Yeah, so it's still expanding. And back then, were some of your early influences, I mean, there were singing storytellers. So, you know, I'm thinking of Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie.
Yeah.
Were you influenced by them?
Pete was a huge influence on me. And of course, I grew up, when I got a guitar, I was pretty political at the end. So I was writing topical songs and Pete was a huge influence. And I was lucky enough to meet him and I got to know him. And he was actually you kind of think you're special when you get a postcard from Pete. And then you find out that thousands and thousands of people got postcards from Pete. When he saw something that he liked, he let people know. We had a correspondence that went back and forth, and he would call sometimes. And he got to know my wife, Debbie, very well. They sat on the board. Debbie was on the board of Sing Out magazine for years. And, you know, sometimes a phone would ring. It would be Pete asking about something. And, like, I'd be late for some place, but Pete would be on the phone talking, which he loved to do. And you go, I can't hang up on Pete Seeger, you know. But I think the thing about Pete and where first of all, he was interested in those two things, that's the story and song, and that his performances were really a combination of that. But he was also understood that music's job is first, it's an expression of community. And so that's what he used his music for, was to build community and call attention to things. And I've tried to keep that in front of me, you know, over the years. So that he's been an influence. And then there are people like, you know, I got to work with Utah Phillips over the years. I really respected his work. And I never worked with Arlo, but I've certainly listened to him a lot. The other thing is, I know it had an influence. My dad had these Stan Freberg records growing up of these dumb skits. And you know, I'm so angry at Bill Cosby, but oh my gosh, I'll be doing a story and I'll hear his delivery in my work. You know, he had a huge influence on me. So that's, which is a great tragedy, you know, what he was doing while that was going on.
Well, I think that, you know, I think about, you have the common touch where people just relate to what you're talking about in your stories, whether they're the grownups or the kids, everybody. And Garrison Keillor also had that sense of humor that made you laugh at something that wasn't necessarily funny, but it was.
Well, you know, he said something that humor is comedy in slow motion. And I mean, it's kind of painting with a broad brush, but like the human condition is almost inherently absurd. That doesn't mean it doesn't have value or doesn't have meaning, but it is just, it's absurd. And it's somebody's, it's like my job as to point out the absurdity. And so it's like, even just the littlest things, like I'm not done with this, but I'm working on this piece. It's going to be like a 10-minute monologue about the junk drawer in my kitchen, because the Tupperware drawer, because it's like, when I have a nightmare, those two drawers open up and things just, you know, you fill something up. You're like, you're an idiot at the end of the meal. You put the in the container and then you turn to find the top and you cannot find the top. And now what are you going to do? Now you've got one thing. You're nodding. You know, I can hear you nodding.
I'm nodding because yes, of course. And that is going to be so funny and so wonderful, because I imagined you were going to talk about the absurdity of the last year. Well, there's going to be a lot of people talking about that. And, you know, it's just, we've been spending a lot of time in our drawers this year. Yeah. So, you know,
Right. This little thing, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's like to see the universe in a grain of sand is like, you take the littlest thing and there is a unit. I'm always asking myself, what's the universal in this experience? And if you can find that, I remember being at a songwriting workshop with Lou and Peter Berryman, who are just incredible songwriters, right? And Peter Berryman said, write about the smallest thing you can. And of course, they've got great songs like How Long Has This Been in the Freezer? And Why Am I Painting the Living Room? And
you know, everybody, in case you're wondering, we're talking to Bill Harley. And Bill Harley is the author and of 35 award-winning recordings. He's won Grammys. He's also written books. And we're going to talk about that in the second half of this interview. Like, his first book was The Amazing Flight of Darius Frobisher. And he's also written a whole series about the trials and tribulations of fourth grader Charlie Bumpers. And I've just finished sending a lot of those things on to my grandchildren. And I would recommend that you look into them too at billharley.com. And you will just listen and listen and listen and laugh and laugh and laugh. And you'll have a hard time deciding what to choose. Bill Harley. So, hey, Bill.
Yeah.
How about a little story?
You know what I think I'm going to do? And I fall back on this story all the time. And it's not one of mine, but it's my favorite story. And I'll kind of accordionize this story, you know, I'll tell briefly, but I learned it from Duncan Williamson, who's a traditional, storyteller from Scotland, one of the traveler people. He was designated a national treasure by the Scottish government for all the stories. And he died about 10 years ago. But I spent some time, I heard him perform actually at the National Storytelling Festival. And then I traveled to Scotland and spent some time with him. Because when he tells a story, it's just like some people, you remember the performance, him, you remember the story. So once there was a king who had everything, but he wasn't happy. Everything. His wife is beautiful. His son and daughter, the prince and princess, were handsome and lovely. Had a huge castle, wonderful kingdom, huge army, scores of horses in his stables. But he wasn't happy. And his wife would say, "What's wrong with you?" And he'd say, "It's just the way I am. It's all right." But it wasn't all right for her.
It bothered her. So she started to go to the wise men to ask them what they could do, what she could do to make them happy. And they all had suggestions, you know, like, you know, put an addition on the castle, or, you know, conquer more territory, get them a new horse, whatever. And they did all those things. She did all those things, and it didn't make any difference. Until finally she came to the last wise man. And he said, if the king would be happy, he must find and wear a happy man's shirt. So she sends the guards out into the kingdom to try to find a happy man, and they can't find one. And they come back, and she goes back to the wise man and said, we can't find a happy man. And he said, I didn't say we, I said him, only the king, only the king. So she goes to him and says, look, would you do this for me? Would you go out and find a happy man and get a shirt and come back? And he said, okay, if it makes you happy, I'll go. So he leaves the next morning, but he doesn't go on his milk white steed or his wear his crown or whatever kings do in their carriages. He just slipped out the back door in the clothes of an everyday person, and he began to try to find a happy man, but he couldn't find one. Everybody he asked had something that was wrong. They said, no, no, no. And he began to think, is this whole kingdom unhappy because of me? But he didn't give up. He stayed out there. And his hair grew long and unkempt, and he wore holes in the elbows of his jacket, and the knees of his pants, the soles of his shoes. Still he looked, and he couldn't find one. So back at the castle, his wife finally says to the guards, go out and find him. I'd rather have him back here and miserable than out there wandering around in the open. So as it would happen, like the next day, it's a folk tale, the king comes down to a stream early in the morning, and he's going to ford over this stream. And as he gets there, he sees this beggar man with his coat pulled over his shoulders, and he's heating up a little tin to make some tea. And he's, you know, singing, oh, what a beautiful morning, or something traditional Scottish, I don't know. And he sees the king, and he goes, hey, buddy, get over here. The king comes over and says, have a seat right there. So the king sits down. He says, look at this. You're going to love this. And he gives the king some tea, and the king tastes it, and it's bitter. But the beggar man smacks him on the back and said, isn't that the best cup of tea you ever had your whole life? And in spite of himself, the king chuckles. The king smiles. And so they start to talk, and at a certain point, the king says, who are you? He says, who am I? Yeah, who are you? He says, oh, I'm a beggar man. I don't care what you call. Just don't call me down. Now, see, the king's genuinely interested in this fellow, right? So he starts more and more and more, and the man's more and more animated. The king's becoming animated. And finally, he says, I got to ask you a question. Beggar man says, fire away. He says, are you happy? What? Are you a happy man? Beggar man says, yeah, sure. Happiest man in the world. The king looks at him and says, why are you happy? He says, I don't know. For one, I didn't get rained on. You know, it looked like we were going to get rain. I was going to be a wet puppy, but no, I did not get rain on. And not only that, I got some breakfast, and you can't always count on breakfast. He said, oh, I see. You're looking at me. You think, what has he got? But I'm going to tell you, he said, I don't have much. So I don't have to worry about whether I should be getting or giving away, what I should do with it, or someone's going to take away from me. I've got something right now. You know, I just do what I can. I do what good I can. I travel around. You tell me, why shouldn't I be happy? The king says, oh, I can't believe I found you. He said, I didn't know I was looking for you. You were looking for me. The king says, do you know who I am? The beggar man says, you're a beggar man like me. He says, no, I am the king. And the beggar man starts to laugh. He says, what's so funny? He says, you're not the king. He says, yes, I am. He says, no, you're not. He says, yes, I am. The beggar man says, no, I'm the king. King says, no, you're not. He says, yes, I am. They start arguing, and finally the beggar man says, we're both kings. He says, look at yourself, buddy. Look at you. And the king looks at himself really for the first time. And he starts to laugh. Says, we're both kings. And they fall over. They're holding their stomachs. They're rolling on the floor, the ground. We're both kings. And it's a folktale. That's when the guards show up, come down the hill. They see the king rolling around on the ground with a beggar man. They throw themselves off their horses. Say, your majesty, we found you. And the king said, I told you. And the beggar man said, ah, I'm so sorry. He said, shh, 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 don't apologize. And the guard says, your majesty, your wife wants you back. And the king says, yeah, there is that. He says, I got to go back. Could I ask a favor of you?
The beggar man says, yeah, I don't have much, but what I have is yours. He said, good.
Could I have your shirt?
The beggar man says, you want my shirt? He starts to laugh.
The king says, what's so funny? And he pulls back his coat and says, I have no shirt. The king said, then you're going to come back with me because you're going to get a shirt and you're going to remind me of what happiness is about. They put him back on a horse. They rode all the way back to the castle. They came in the main entrance, you know, the front entrance of the castle. His wife said, you're back. He said, I found a happy man. He doesn't have a shirt. And the beggar man stayed with the king to remind him of what happiness was about. Now, I do want to say, I heard this story when I was in my 30s, and I felt like I had the weight of the world on me. I was, you know, trying to make a living, just barely scraping by. I had two kids. I didn't know what I was like. And I thought, why didn't he just stay out there? But now I know, because I think Duncan was saying, we all have castles we live in, that we have to live in. It's the world we've made. But when you go back to your castle, make sure you leave room in your heart for the beggar man. And that's a story I learned from Duncan Williamson.
Thank you so much, Bill, for telling that great story. It is certainly great. I totally enjoyed it. And is that available for anybody to find?
I'm trying to think if I've recorded it. I think it's on Nothing for Granted.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Yeah. And they can always find it here on the podcast page at KPTC, because you're listening to KPTC, Book Lovers Cafe. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Here we are at 91.9 Port Townsend. And Bill Harley is with us today all the way from Massachusetts. And he's been telling stories for 40 years. And now, you know, he's kind of moving into things that are new and different, as you said before. So let's talk a little bit about some of the newer things you've done. First of all, you started writing these books.
I did. I mean, I think because of my mom was a writer, I kind of always had it. I had a couple of thoughts. I always had it in my mind that I like to turn some of my stories into books and write stories that are just for the printed page. And then getting back to what I said earlier, I didn't know. I mean, you know, I'm not traveling now, but I came to believe I was going to need to find something I could do to stay at home a little bit. And so that was writing. It's a whole other it's a whole other kettle of fish, you know? I mean, there's a lot of things that are similar in terms of being an artist and creating things, but, you know, the publishing world, the vagaries of the publishing world and all that other stuff, it's interesting.
Yeah. Is Charlie Bumpers a little bit of you? Is he a little bit of your own children, your own?
Well, I will tell you, although there's things that happen in the Charlie Bumpers books, I don't think there's anything specific that happened to me, but a really good friend of mine who I went to college with, who's the principal of an elementary school. When the first book came out, I sent it to her. She's known me forever since college. When the first book came out, she called me up and she said, "Hey, Bill, nice autobiography. Charlie is disorganized and, you know, and a bunch of other things, but very kind of normal in some ways.
Yeah. And I heard that you were writing or have written an opera as well called Weed Patch.
I had a musical I started to work on many years ago, which never actually with Oscar Eustace, who's now the director, the artistic director of the Public Theater in New York. That brought Hamilton to the stage, but he was a Trinity rep in Providence, and I had started to work on a musical with him, and one reason or another didn't go anywhere. But it was this idea I had about there's a book by a guy named Jerry Herman called Children of the Dust Bowl, and it's about this camp
a migrant labor camp in Southern California during the Depression. And it's actually a camp that Steinbeck visited. It's in Grapes of Wrath. And the kids in that camp were so discriminated against in the public schools, the superintendent of those schools in Kern County decided they should just have their own school. So they built their own school. And it was just this beautiful bloom for 3 or 4 years of these kids learning both academics and vocation. And when I read the book, I thought, this is a great musical. And so when I was approached by North Cape Family Opera, I asked Paul Phillips, who was at Brown University at the time and is now at Stanford, a composer, if he wanted to do it. Yeah, so we wrote an opera based on that.
Such great material and such a good thing to be writing about. So what are you looking forward to next year?
All the festivals in the fall and the winter got postponed, and I'm hoping that maybe next fall we'll be able to look at doing it. I don't know if we will or not. I've got actually 3 things that are coming out this year that I've been working on for a couple of years. One of them is a radio drama series. It's produced by BYU Productions in Utah. It's about a middle school kid who forms a detective agency and can't do anything right. It's called Quentin Manning, Detective for Justice. And they're going to do a big radio production. It's 17 episodes.
Please let me know about that.
I will. I'm very excited about it. So I finished, all the episodes are all written. Now they're casting, but everything's been put on hold. I've got an adult album coming out that should be out by February called Walking Each Other Home, which has got about a dozen songs on it. And I've got a new book, a kid's book, a young adult book coming out called Now You Say Yes, about a 15-year-old girl who drives across the country with her 9-year-old brother who's on the spectrum trying to find their grandmother.
These are all things that we can really look forward to. And I've so enjoyed spending this time with you this morning. Thanks for joining me on Zoom. And we've been talking to Bill Harley. You can find out more about him. You can hear him. You can see him. You can listen to him. You can find his albums, his cassettes, and all his books at billharley.com. And please join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to this show if you joined in the middle on the podcast page and all my past shows at kptz.org. Make a donation while you're there to the station as well. I'd like to thank the editors for this show, David Kurland and Carl Allen, who smooth out all the rough edges. Thanks to all the volunteers and supporters. And remember, Bill's Rules of the Universe that you can read on his website, one of them is, if you are older than 2 and can't sing a song or tell a story, you're in trouble. So we'll go out with that. Thank you so much, Bill, again. And
My pleasure.
Hope to talk to you next year.
It's a deal.
That'd be great.